Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi there and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And the topic I'm going to talk about today is something that I have a kind of an abiding fascination for. And it is a continuation of the podcast I did a couple of weeks ago on everyday life in Stalin's Russia and also the views that many ordinary Soviet citizens had of the future and this idea of utopianism that seems to have existed alongside periods of famine and intense political violence. Once again, we're looking at Sheila Fitzpatrick's Everyday Stalinism. If you do get a chance to read it, it's an enormously important book and one which will dramatically change your views of Stalinist Russia, and she's one of the foremost scholars on the subject, and also the idea of Stalinism and the everyday. So, she writes, "The generation that grew up in the 1930s took the words, 'We shall build our world, a new world,' from the Internationale, the Russian national anthem, to heart. Most memoirs about the period, including many written in emigration, recall the idealism and optimism of the young, their belief that they were participants in a historic process of transformation, their enthusiasm for what was called the building of socialism, the sense of adventure they brought to it, and their willingness, at least rhetorical, to go off as pioneers to distant construction sites like Magnitogorsk or Komsomolsk in the Amur. Tara was not part of this picture." So, it's very easy when studying Soviet Russia, for example, at an earlier age in GCSE or A-level or whatever the equivalent qualification is wherever you're listening in the world, to assume that Soviet citizens existed in blind terror most of the time. The same can be misleadingly assumed of Nazism as well. These were states with secret policemen and dictators, and surely everybody had these thoughts and feelings. They must have been terrified of the government. Well, there were of course, widespread anxieties and fears, and during periods of terror in the Soviet Union, life was highly unpredictable. During periods of terror, in fact, many Soviet citizens justified the terror and said, well, you know, they must have done something, and the state doesn't make mistakes. They are looking for troublemakers, and it must be those people. But also, as described here, a generation of young people engaged with the Stalinist project, engaged with the five-year plans, believed it was their duty to engage and involve themselves in this process of historical construction. And part of that is because of the very nature of Marxist-Leninism. So, as far as sort of Marxist-Leninist doctrine goes, communism, the utopia, is somewhere in the future. what the phase of socialism in the Soviet Union was meant to be. It was perhaps not necessarily nice or comfortable, because it's building towards this future world. And it's actually quite an attractive proposition to be part of this process. There have been people throughout history who have believed themselves to be pioneers or creators of a new world, or creators of, or recreators of an old world, and they shape their lives, their sense of selves, their identity, social and individual, around this task. So it's not uncommon. The son-in-law of Nikita Khrushchev, who was the editor of Izvestia, was a schoolboy in 1937. He writes, interestingly, the only thing that existed for that year was Spain, the fight with the fascists. Spanish caps, blue with red edging along the visor, came into fashion. Also big berets, which tilted at a rakish angle for boys and girls at that time. The world divided only into whites and reds. It didn't even come into our heads to think which side we should be on. It was the red world, in which the polar explorers, Chelyuskinites, who were rescuers of a team stranded in the Arctic in 1934, and Papaninites, named after Ivan Papanin's record-breaking aviation team, lived and accomplished their heroic feats. It's a fascinating extract. What the reference to Spain, of course, is the Spanish Civil War, in which the Soviet Union had participated and had supported the Republic against the Spanish generals who were supported by Hitler and Mussolini. And it merges, that struggle merges with the process of modernization in the imagination of young Soviet citizens. It was a struggle in the eyes of young Soviet citizens between modernity, which seemed to be represented in popular discourse in the Soviet Union by polar explorers and aviators. There is a fascination with both. They both represent something heroic and exciting, but something kind of modern, but and also egalitarian, because in the new world of the Soviet Union, anyone could be an aviator and anyone could be a polar explorer. The juxtaposition of this is the kind of medieval barbarity of the Spanish generals who wished to restore a Catholic Spain, a fascist Catholic Spain, that would essentially drag the peasantry back into the Middle Ages. This was the Manichaean struggle, the binary struggle between lightness and darkness that the young Soviet pioneers perceived. The other diarist that's mentioned here is one of Ajube's contemporaries, Raisa Orlova, who later became a dissident and emigrated in the post-Stalin period. She said of her youth, "I had an unshakable faith that my existence between these old walls in an apartment on Gorky Street was merely a preparation for life. Life, properly speaking, would begin in a new and sparkling white house. There I would do exercises in the morning. There I would order and exist. There all my heroic achievements would commence." The majority of my contemporaries shared the same kind of rough, provisional, slapdash way of life. Faster, faster, towards the great goal. And there, everything would begin in a genuine sense. It was both possible and necessary to alter everything, the streets, the houses, the cities, the social order, human souls. And it was not all that difficult. The first and selfish enthusiasts would outline the plan on paper, then they would tear down the old, saying all the while, "You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs." Then the ground would be cleared and the rubble and the edifice of the socialist phalanx would be erected in the space that had been cleared. So, for example, what she speaks of is actually what happens in Moscow Moscow, essentially the old medieval Tsarist Moscow is swept away, and a 20th century stone and concrete city is erected in its place. Streets are widened, entire boulevards are moved, and the old buildings of the old medieval world are knocked down to make place for kind of concrete palaces of modernity. It's interesting that Raisa Orlova talks about this idea of her future, you know, this idea of things happening in the future, of going from existence between these old walls to a sparkling new white house. It's almost a kind of a metaphor, it's perhaps kind of in her unconscious mind, this metaphor for the advancement of modernity, the kind of the creation of the future itself. The general plan for the reconstruction of Moscow that was meant to set a plan for a pattern for urban planning throughout the Soviet Union created a sort of like a picture of kind of modernistic advance for citizens to be kind of wowed by, and for also particularly for foreign visitors. And I talked a lot in this podcast about the fellow traveller movement, the likes of the Webbs, George Bernard Shaw, various American and French fellow travellers who came to look at the extraordinary advances being made in the Soviet Union while their own countries were in sort of languishing in economic doldrums. The plans and blueprints and models seemed to be in every public building, in every public space. There were films about the creation of new cities. The film Chebada by the Georgian filmmaker Mikhail Chirelli showed models of a kind of almost a Fritz Lang sort of future city where there was a kind of a commentary talking through where schools and hospitals and buildings would be. One of the great projects of modernity in Moscow in the early 1930s was the creation of the Moscow Metro. The Moscow Metro, if you've ever been on it, is an extraordinary piece of architecture, one of the truly beautiful public spaces. Beautiful because one of the intentions of the Stalinists was to take the grandeur of royal palaces and put it in a public space so that people could enjoy artwork and chandeliers in a democratized space. Democratized in the loosest sense of the word, but democratized as kind of aesthetics brought from behind palace walls out into the public. The idea, of course, was to create public spaces that people would want to spend time in. The Soviet regime was very suspicious of private spaces. They thought private spaces was a rejection of collectivist values, and also private spaces are where one can be conspiratorial. Nobody knows quite what is going on behind closed doors.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Deep escalators and spacious stations on the metro were astonishing to citizens who'd never seen this sort of thing before, and very, very popular with them. There in Moscow, architecture was by its very nature kind of grand. It was monumentalist. The kind of Stalinist architecture created buildings as grand as the Moscow Hotel, with 1,200 rooms that was to be built close to Red Square. The palace was a concept which kind of was captured the age. It was these kind of democratic people sort of palaces. These were huge buildings that would be kind of for culture, for sport, for mass entertainment, for film. And they were often referred to as palaces of labour. They had a very brutalist and yet merged with classicist architecture that seemed to be a way of announcing to the Soviet populace that all architectural styles were now combined within socialist, Stalinist architecture. And that was a way of saying that all the architecture of the past had been working towards this one historical moment when a kind of a new aesthetic was to begin. The modernists, such as Tatlin, who had been in favour very, very briefly during the early Leninist era, were quickly got rid of under Stalin, and their rather daring ideas about architecture were swept away for kind of more formal conservatism. The planned Palace of the Soviets that never got built in the end was part of Moscow's general plan. It was on the site of the Christ the Saviour Cathedral, which was demolished in the early 1930s. The palace never got built because of its vast size. It was going to be a simply enormous building with a huge statue of Lenin on the top. There was too much groundwater and the weight would have sunk into the earth. And obviously, Orthodox Russian Christians believe that this was kind of God's punishment for destroying his cathedral. But the image was, even though it didn't get built, the image kind of continues as one of Soviet Russia. Many Soviet citizens have been forgiven for thinking it actually existed. It appeared on propaganda posters and in the film by Alexandra Medvedkins, who filmed the movie New Moscow in 1939, which saw the Palace of the Soviets, a kind of a graphic of it imposed on street scenes, which was a kind of one of the kind of the great moments, great imaginary moments of socialist realist cinema. Streets were widened, particularly the famous Gorky Street, and the old medieval facades of houses were got rid of. A kind of a uniformity was created in the style of Stalinist architecture that on four street fronts, and it was vastly labour intensive. Gulag labour was used to clear the streets along with free workers. When the streets were widened, entire buildings were moved metres backwards. Quite how, I'm not sure. One would have to ask an architect or an engineer, but certainly that's what occurred. The problem with all of this is that much of it was a facade. It was impossible to simply construct a new Soviet Union. It was impossible to simply build the future with many of the old values of cultural and economic backwardness and corruption not still existing behind. And there was much thought amongst the Stalinists as to what could be done, how society could be jolted into the future, and Soviet citizens forced to kind of conform to some sort of standard. Policies were introduced, such as the policy of kulturnost, or culturedness, which punished workers for laziness, for absenteeism, for drinking, for swearing, and generally being the kind of backward peasant type that Russia was trying to move away from. But ultimately, much of old Russia sustains itself. Lenin said that socialism cannot be built in one country so long as that terrible centuries-old gulf still separates the small part of it that is industrialized and civilized from the part that is uncivilized, patriarchal, and oppressed for centuries through slavery and colonial exploitation. So the kind of the old values of the past had made a particular kind of person in Lenin's view. So during the 1930s, dramatic changes take place, as we know. By the end of the 20s, one-fifth, or under a fifth of the population was urban. That figure would rise to a third by the end of the 1930s. So the complete total number of wage and salary-earning workers in the late 20s stood at 11 million, out of a population of 150 million. And this figure would triple in a decade. So this is the story of massive, massive urbanisation. 11 million was also the figure for children in school in the late 20s, of whom 3 million were in secondary schools. A decade later, there was 30 million children in schools, 18 million of them in secondary schools. Only 57% of all Soviet people aged 9 to 49 were literate in 1926, although that said, illiteracy was concentrated in the rural parts of Russia and in Central Asia. But the urban population was 81% literate. By 1939, 81% of the entire Soviet population was literate. So there were some extraordinary achievements under the Soviet regime in terms of literacy, in terms of urbanisation. Of course, we've talked in the past that this massive, massive, rapid transition towards urbanisation caused huge economic hardship. But there were these kinds of achievements were the things that the regime focused on, and the evidence that young Soviet citizens had that things were dramatically improving. And it's small wonder that you get a generation of pioneers, a generation of optimists, a generation of people who believe that the journey into the future is untrammelled because of their experience of leaping from illiterate peasant living standards to urbanised, educated life within one generation. They have suddenly, dramatically, large numbers of them become modern people. Achievement was accompanied by exaggeration and bragging, partly because of the nature of Stalinism. The party bosses across the country would brag and exaggerate their own achievements in order to advance their careers and stay out of trouble. Statistical books were published, and they were often published in foreign languages for the likes of people like the Fabians to read and be misled by. The data on things that weren't working was excluded from these, obviously. And the Soviet press constantly boasted about hydroelectric projects and agricultural projects and blast furnaces, modern technology, changing the nature of the Soviet Union. Impressive achievements by aviators, again, this is the subject of great fascination in the Soviet Union, and polar explorers who survived the hazards of the Arctic were also championed. And the other thing that is constantly mentioned are changes in the living standards of women, the emancipation of women from the traditional ways of Russian peasant misogyny and patriarchy, the increase in literacy, and the numbers of kindergartens that were liberating women to go to work. And the thing that we'll look at in the not-too-distant future is this fascination with work and almost this obsession with work, this idea that going to work makes you modern and going to work makes you a contributor to society and therefore a Soviet citizen, part of the building of socialist modernity. Okay, well, we're going to leave it there because otherwise we start to kind of go into something else. But the part of all of this that's perhaps worth remembering in terms of propaganda was that there was a belief in being able within a generation to overtake the West, that socialism would prove that it was more able than Western capitalism to provide ever higher living standards if it wasn't kind of encircled by hostile capitalist powers. And within the midst of this modernity, within the midst of this advance, within the midst of this growth in living standards, there was the belief, not entirely unjustified by the Soviet state and by Soviet people, that also Soviet Russia must arm itself to defend the revolution and to defend these advances for ordinary people, whom, if the Soviet Union was invaded, would be dragged back into serfdom. And in many ways, considering the invasion that does come in 1941, that's quite prescient and quite prophetic. So thanks very much for listening. It's been great to chat with you about this morning, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.